My name is Stanley Hahn. I hold my doctorate from the University of Florida from the Department of Immunology and Molecular Genetics from 1978. My doctoral dissertation was the discovery of a new virus of the viral family retroviridae, which is an RNA virus. Unlike the coronavirus, it is a retrovirus, which means it carries reverse transcriptase, that it goes through a DNA replicative stage in multiplying, just like the AIDS virus. The AIDS virus is also in the retrovirus family. My postdoctoral work was mainly for the CDC at the University of Florida for the endemicity of rabies in the animal population, the wild animal population in Florida. Did surveys of raccoons that were that carried seropositive antibodies to rabies, to the rhabdovirus, which causes rabies. And here I am.
Okay, so look, you mentioned there the AIDS and the retroviruses. What makes those different to a normal virus, if there is such a thing as a normal virus?
Well, okay, to start with, a virus is usually an envelope, a capsule with genetic material inside of it. It cannot replicate on its own. A virus is a refined colonizer, and it colonizes your cells. It uses your own cell's replicative mechanism to replicate itself. It takes over the mechanism of your cell. It literally colonizes the cell and makes the cell become a virus factory. Is that clear?
Yeah, it sounds like it's hijacking your cell.
Yes, that's how viruses, that's why they call them obligate intracellular organisms. Because they don't have any of their own replicative mechanism. So what they do is that they use your cell as a virus factory. They take over the cell. As soon as their genetic material starts to get translated, it shuts off the regular cell production and makes the cell become a virus producer. And that's how viruses, until there's enough of them, the cell lyses and they go out and infect other cells. That's how viruses replicate. And there are two kinds of viruses. Some carry DNA in their inside the core. Others carry RNA, so that's the main classification. You can either have DNA viruses, such as the herpes viruses, or RNA viruses, such as the AIDS virus, such as the flu virus, such as our actual coronavirus.
Okay, so these retroviruses, what makes them different to the average virus then, that the AIDS and the ones you studied?
Okay, well, there's not much difference between the one I discovered and the AIDS virus because they belong in the same family. The one I discovered is a syncytium-forming virus, what they call in the subfamily Spumavirinae. They both carry reverse transcriptase. The virus, once it gets inside the cell, they're RNA viruses, they go through the reverse transcriptase, transforms their RNA into DNA. And then from there, your own cell starts to replicate the DNA and starts to produce the viral proteins that are necessary for the capsule and replicates the DNA. In other words, produces viruses. Now, what makes the AIDS virus different is that it causes, you know, serious pathology. It takes over your cells that are responsible for your immune system. So therefore, your immune system can no longer function. Your T cells, which are your primary defense against viruses, what they call killer T cells, are totally neutralized by, they are the targets of, you know, the AIDS virus, of the human immunodeficiency virus. And this renders your immune system useless. When somebody dies of AIDS, they die because they cannot protect themselves against any of the infectious diseases that are around, that you usually go, you know, you defend yourself, your immune system keeps them in check, or even some of your enteric bacteria can become invasive because you have no defense, you know, whatsoever. And with AIDS, what they were seeing is people with what they call pneumocystic pneumonia, which usually, this is a fungus that doesn't usually cause pneumonia in healthy people, but in AIDS, you know, people died from it. We inhale those spores every day, but in a healthy person, it doesn't cause, you know, a pathology. Other things is that was very distinct for people with AIDS is Kaposi's sarcoma, which is not very common, which people with normal immune system that are not immunocompromised, that are not immunodeficient, they don't get that kind of sarcoma. Whereas the people with AIDS, it would be one of the diagnostic signs of AIDS would be the Kaposi's sarcoma on the skin, which look purple. And of course, other infections. Enteric, one of the things that accompanied AIDS was diarrhea also.
So the main point here is that it's the cells that are being targeted by AIDS, which are your T cells, the main immune defense system. That's what made it so exceptional. So what about successful ways to stop the AIDS virus? Obviously, this is something very, very dangerous when someone, it's a bit like maybe something like haemophilia, where there's really almost nothing you can do about it if somebody has got no defense system. In haemophilia, obviously, it's about your blood won't clot and, you know, it won't form together if you bleed, you know, there won't be any stopping of the bleeding. But and the similar thing in AIDS, where there's almost nothing you can do. So how did science get around this, you know, in order to tackle AIDS?
That's very interesting, and it's very interesting that you should have chosen hemophiliacs, because one of the first victims of AIDS were hemophiliacs, because they were receiving the blood clotting factor that you're talking about from, you know, the blood supply, the commercial blood supply that was around, which was contaminated. And okay, to do a little go around, at the beginning, AIDS was affecting four groups of people. So they gave it the word four H's, especially around Florida, because where they were seeing it most was among homosexuals, heroin addicts, hemophiliacs, and Haitians. So they had given it some people were calling it the four H's. Now, we've known subsequently that it came to Haiti from the United States. And how science has gotten around it is a very good question. We have not found, a vaccine for the AIDS virus. And you can imagine why. It's very difficult to produce a vaccine for the AIDS virus because it precisely affects your immune system. So the way they got around it is by finding antiviral drugs, drugs that inhibited the replication of the AIDS virus. AZT, actinomycin D, rifampin, and some new things that are coming. Now, some of these, remember I explained to you that the retroviruses use reverse, they carry their reverse transcriptase, which is an enzyme that transforms RNA into DNA as a stage in its replication. Well, something like actinomycin D is a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. So it blocks the replication of the virus at a certain stage. And right now, what we have between the cocktail of three antiviral drugs, and some pharmaceutical companies are making drugs that combine all three, AIDS has become manageable. It has been kept in the dormant state. And AIDS is not the only thing that stays in a dormant state, to the point where people who are HIV positive, who perhaps started having symptoms of acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which is what AIDS stands for, and got cured, and the virus is now, you can't say that they got rid of the virus because somewhere it stays latent and may come back. That's why they are on those drugs, some, you know, for life, but they can even have normal sexual relations without transmitting it. They are no longer contagious. They are no longer infectious. And this is not a rare phenomenon. It's just like we see the same phenomenon in chickenpox. When you get chickenpox and you get over it, the virus can remain latent in what they call the dorsal ganglia of your body for 30, 40 years, 50 years. And then later reappear as shingles. It's the exact same virus. And even though you have antibody to it, doesn't become a systemic disease because you would immediately form a secondary response and antibodies to neutralize it. It usually travels through the intercostal nerves and reappear. They can reappear anywhere from the face down the trunk, but usually only on one side of the body. It's not quite clear why usually it appears on one side of the body, even though lately people have been describing bilateral shingles.
So, okay. So we've got a picture, haven't we, of COVID vaccine now. It's called an mRNA vaccine, which is the Pfizer and Moderna type of a vaccine, which is being used. You know, for example, Prince Philip apparently had the Pfizer one because it was the only one approved in Britain at the time, although I don't know if the royal family are allowed to just bypass the rules. He had some sort of a bad reaction to it, although, of course, the palace are denying that. Now, these mRNA vaccines, it's absolutely clear if you look at the literature, this is an experimental trial that's going on human beings now, and this has only been allowed because we've got an apparent emergency due to COVID. We keep hearing about these mRNA vaccines, though. Apparently, some people say they do change your DNA. Other people say they don't change their DNA. And it doesn't seem as if there's any kind of meeting of minds. So I wonder if you can do a little bit of mediation here, Stanley, and say whether it is actually going in and changing the DNA of a cell or not.
Okay, well, the correct answer, the correct statement on it is that it can do it. I cannot tell you that it does it, nor can anybody tell you with absolute certainty that it doesn't. Scientists who are saying, oh no, this is ridiculous, I will challenge them to an argument anytime. And I can't say that it does, but what I do know is that it's theoretically possible, because you are injected with mRNA, which is the mRNA that codes, that translate into the spike protein of the virus. This mRNA is injected intramuscularly. Normally, they say it's those muscle cells will be the first to pick it up. That mRNA goes inside the cells. It is transported to the protein-making mechanism of the cell, the ribosomes, where that spike protein, which is the attachment site of the virus, your cells start making the spike protein of the virus. It migrates to your, as long as it stays inside the cell, it will not activate your immune system. It has to migrate to the cellular membrane where your immune cells can see it and detect a foreign antigen on the surface of your cells. And this, you know, activates an immune response to the spike protein of the coronavirus, and you attack it. The T cells that become primed to it will destroy those cells which are presenting, because this is, you have two kinds of cellular response. One is called humoral. It's made by B cells, B lymphocytes, that actually manufacture your antibodies, and T lymphocytes that become killer T cells that actually kill the whole infected cell when it recognizes it as foreign. That, in theory, is how it should work. But there's also, when you're injected with that mRNA, you don't know if some of it obviously will get in your bloodstream, which will circulate it through your body. There is no data that other cells from other organs will not pick it up. And that is a definite possibility, even though they say that it's unstable. RNA is usually unstable, but you don't know how many, you know, how much of it may escape, may get picked up by other cells. And the reason they say that it can become part of your DNA is because some cells in your body carry reverse transcriptase. So this mRNA can be reverse transcripted into DNA and get incorporated in your genome. It's not, you know, there are examples of things like this, you know, all over. I can't say for sure that it will, but what I can tell you is that it's definitely possible that it becomes part of your own DNA.
Okay, so it may only just be like one or two cells, though, which after a while will die off, surely.
Not necessarily. Why would the cell die off if it does? It could incorporate it into its DNA, not produce the viral antigen just yet, and multiply, as cells usually multiply, and this DNA will multiply. Now, whether it gets recognized as foreign and destroyed, then you run the risk, if it's of an autoimmune disease, where, you know, your cells, your T cells, are recognizing your own cells as a foreign entity, which is what the vaccine is supposed to do. That's exactly what the saying, that it will only remain locally and simply activate locally your immune system. What other people, what I'm saying, is that that mRNA may get into your circulatory system and reach other organs where cells may pick it up, like hepatic cells. So it is possible, but it's, like I said, the correct question is not, does it alter your genome or it doesn't alter? The correct question is, can it happen? And it can happen. As far as,
I mean, these mRNA vaccines are very new. I know they've been trying to get them approved for something like 15 years, and this is a big opportunity for these pharmaceutical companies to get approval with a pandemic. But what about, I mean, there must be some reason why the common cold, it's not been possible to get coronavirus vaccines in the past. I mean, they've been trying to do this for decades and decades. And I wonder, you know, how did they get on with these mRNA vaccines? If they tried them on animals, and did they get on very well with them with animals? Do you know?
Let me give you an example. The polio vaccine, which is something that was vital for humanity, which is still vital in case polio makes a reappearance, was tested for about 6 to 7 years before it was given to school children. So in an animal model, you can see, first of all, the how effective it is in activating the immune system. And then you can check for, after a couple of years, for latent effects, dormant effects that would appear later on. This we haven't done with these mRNA vaccines that are now on the market, because they started developing this SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccines last January. They tried it for the SARS-1, but it never got ready for it. The reason for that is that RNA is very unstable. So Pfizer and Moderna used nanolipid particles to sort of protect the RNA. Now, exactly how is their trade secret? They call it their intellectual property. But can they guarantee that it will not go elsewhere, that it will not find its way to other organs, such as the liver or the heart, where your cells may pick it up and perhaps start making viral antigen, and then be recognized as foreign, and you get an autoimmune disease? By the way, this is exactly what rheumatic heart fever is. Rheumatic heart fever is, after having some strep infection, the strep has antigen that makes your immune, when you make antibodies to it, these antibodies cross-react with antigens that are in some of your heart muscles. That's why people with rheumatic heart fever try, you try to make sure they don't get any infections, strep infections, because that would activate their immune system and their heart would get attacked. That's the danger that I think might exist with the corona mRNA vaccines.
Well, that's interesting, because we know that the Duke of Edinburgh has a history of heart problem, and they're saying that he's got some sort of infection now. But sorry, you want to finish making your point?
No, I was going to say that the other route that was taken to make this vaccine was not by injecting this mRNA directly into the people to be vaccinated. But what, for example, the Russians did, they took that same messenger RNA, used reverse transcriptase to make it into the DNA and put it in the genome of an adenovirus. Now, when you get that vaccine, the reason that I think it's a safer route is because the adenovirus will only get into cells that have natural receptors for adenoviruses. So this restricts the distribution of it, and I think makes it less probable that it will get picked up by other organs. And it's proving to be very effective. The other advantage is that you don't have to keep it at minus 20 or minus 70 degrees. Why they went that route is a bit of a mystery to me. Obviously, it's faster, but the Russians were ahead for the simple reason that they were developing that kind of virus for SARS-1. So the Gamaleya Institute was ahead in that race to make an adenovirus carrier of the corona antigen, okay? Using an adenovirus vector. Johnson & Johnson is doing the same. And they're about 6 months behind the Russians. And I think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine should be out around now.
Can you just define what an adenovirus is?
Well, an adenovirus, you know, there are thousands of different types of viruses. An adenovirus is a type of virus that causes a common respiratory infections like colds, similar to rhinoviruses, which also cause colds. They are not, you know, they're very ubiquitous in nature, and people get adenovirus infections often. They're not, you know, their morbidity or mortality rate is very, very low. Now, anybody can die from anything, especially if they're, you know, their immune system is compromised, either by, say, the AIDS virus or immunotherapy, chemotherapy, which, you know, poisons your immune system also. And adenoviruses are very common viruses. That's why using them as a vector to immunize against other viruses is a good idea.
Okay, so we've seen the rollout of all these various different vaccines. Which ones do you think have proved the most spectacular, and which one's the worst, and why?
Well, let me say that the most spectacular, the one that has proven to me most effective, and I think theoretically the safest, and I insist, theoretically the safest, is the Sputnik vaccine. Then the Chinese went another route themselves. What they're using is just the spike protein of the virus in an adjuvant. An adjuvant is something that stimulates your immune system, but it's not as effective as the Russian vaccine. It's safe, but not as effective. And then you have your RNA, mRNA vaccines, which seem to, according to their data, have the same effectiveness as the Sputnik vaccine. But if I had a choice myself, I would, of course we don't, because we're not going to import the Sputnik virus here in the US, even though you have it in England. Because if I'm not mistaken, AstraZeneca has been using the Sputnik V as a booster for their second shot, because they noticed that it took up, it brought protection from 75% to 92-93% after the second booster, when they use the Sputnik vaccine. Now, the other thing that's going on, which is sort of inexplicable, is the complete disappearance here in the United States, very mysterious, of the flu. We're having the mildest flu season ever.
Isn't that just simply because you've got people's bodies are kind of occupied with COVID, and so the flu hasn't been able to get a foothold?
Well, there's been an argument put forward for that. One of the arguments put forward is that all the precautions that we are taking for the COVID in order to stop the pandemic is what caused the disappearance of the flu. And to show you how much of a disappearance, the CDC reported last week that the number of surveillance cases total in the United States has been 1,380. Hospitals, regional hospitals that usually receive 10,000 hospitalization per flu season, have been reporting zero hospitalization for the flu. So the explanation is that, well, social separation, taking care of the flu. But there's an argument against that. The flu virus, the influenza virus, has a size of between 80 and 120 nanometer in average diameter. The coronavirus between 100 and 140 nanometer. They are transmitted airborne the same way, through aerial droplets. And if you touch something that has those, your flu. So if they inhibited the flu as much, reduced the corona pandemic as much as they reduced the flu, there is no reason why a mask would stop the flu virus and not stop the coronavirus, which is on average a bit bigger. Like I said, they're transmitted the same way. And they have, so that argument doesn't stand water. If these precautions reduced and almost eliminated the flu, they should have been extremely effective and stopped the pandemic. They didn't. Whether it's wearing masks or social distancing. The other thing is what you said, that they say, well, the COVID-19 virus overwhelmed the flu virus. I would like to, and they say the same way, some more virulent flu variants can overwhelm another strain of flu. Now that argument doesn't really hold water. For the simple reason, I'd like for somebody to explain to me how the COVID coronavirus could eliminate the flu virus. They don't use the same receptor site. They're not competing for the cells. There must be another explanation. I don't know if, oh, I have to tell you that my cousin who is, in Montreal in Canada, she's an emergency room doctor, told me they've even stopped testing for the flu now in Montreal. So I'm wondering if a lot of the, the cases of COVID-19 do not have as comorbidity the flu also. Perhaps the reason not so much the flu has disappeared is because perhaps we're not testing as much for it. And now there's this habit of attributing all, morbidities, all sicknesses and all mortalities to the COVID-19 virus, even if you have accompanying diseases that could kill you.
I suppose it could also, Stanley, be that people who've got the flu just simply will stomach it now rather than seek treatment, seek testing, because they know that by going to a hospital, going to a doctor, you know, whatever it is they're doing, that they may be actually exposing themselves to COVID.
Yes, absolutely. But there's something else that it should be that it doesn't explain. Yeah, some people maybe, okay, say they have the flu, they said they don't want to get exposed to COVID, or they don't want to get stuck in a hospital with people with COVID. But how do you explain that the average, and I'm going from the 2010-2011 flu season up to the 2019-2020 flu season. The worst was the 2007-2008 flu season, where we had about 50,000 deaths. The most benign was I think 2010-2011, where there was only 10,000 mortalities. This flu season, the average death toll from the flu for the last 10 years has been 30,000 a year. That's the average, from a high of 50,000 to a low of 15,000 some years. The average is, you know, around between 30 and 40,000 deaths per flu season. This year, we haven't had, up to last week, we didn't have any. Yesterday, an article just came out saying that whereas last year's flu season, that is the 2019-2020 flu season, there were 200 children that died of the flu. This year, only one child has died from the flu from September 2020 up to yesterday. So staying away from hospitals, being afraid of getting infected with COVID, does not explain that.
So what does?
Like I said, I don't have an explanation. The explanations that were given, I don't think, hold water. Like I said, they say it's the precautionary measures for the COVID pandemic that has kept the flu down. Well, it should have affected the COVID pandemic as well, because they are similar sized viruses and they are transmitted in similar fashion. So proportionally, it should have reduced the COVID pandemic in the same proportion that it reduced the flu, the usual flu epidemic.
So what's been going on?
I don't really know. I posed that question on ResearchGate, which is a scientific forum. I've posed that question on Facebook. But really, I haven't seen an adequate answer. And I don't pretend to have an answer. I'm just telling you, it's very, very puzzling.
Yeah, so can you speculate on what it might be?
Well, I don't know if perhaps some of the morbidities and mortalities being attributed to COVID may be from the flu. Or if by some miracle this year the flu decided not to come, which is not scientifically plausible. The only speculation I can have is that perhaps it's been associated with, as comorbidity with COVID, and people being tested for COVID are not tested for the flu. And people going to the hospital because of COVID may have the flu as a comorbidity. Because I have to tell you, the average, we're talking about the average number of fatalities, but the average number of hospital visits for the flu is about 200,000 a year. This year, it's almost non-existent. This flu season up to now. And like I said, I just received communication of one confirmed death of one child this flu season from the flu. Last year, the number was 200 plus. I think it was 203. By the way, infectious disease scientists are chronicling something never seen before. The complete the disappearance of most respiratory and gastrointestinal viruses during the corona pandemic. And they are postulating that this is because of the protocols that were taken to stem the flow of the coronavirus. Now imagine that, that all the protocols that we followed to stem the flow of the coronavirus stem the flow of most respiratory viruses, influenza and rhinoviruses and adenoviruses, and the flow of gastrointestinal viruses, but didn't stem the flow of the coronavirus for which we took them. We adopted them. That's kind of ironic.
Yes, but is that the real reason why these viruses appear to have disappeared, or could there be another reason?
Well, like I said, and to me, you know, it's very puzzling. And I, let me be like your compatriot, Isaac Newton. When they asked him to explain, he described gravity, but when he was asked to explain how is this force exerted, he replied, hypothesis non fingo, I frame no hypothesis. So I'll give you the same answer. It's very puzzling, but I can't frame a hypothesis right now. Simply, I can say that the hypothesis being put forward should have worked, if it worked for these other respiratory viruses that are transmitted in the exact same manner as the coronavirus, that are approximately the same size as the coronavirus, it should have worked for the coronavirus.
Now, let me postulate some other potential reason, and that is because there's been a lot of questions about the PCR testing. And in fact, the inventor of the PCR test said that it should never be used as a diagnostic like this. Really, it should be used for other tests. So if you test positive on the PCR, then there's a good justification for taking further tests. But the World Health Organization themselves in January made it absolutely clear that governments around the world should not be relying just on the PCR test, saying, for example, that if the COVID-19 incidence is going down almost to zero, then you could end up with a lot of tests positive still, but that you're getting results which are all false positive tests. So do you think that it could be that the PCR test hasn't been the best test to use? And if so, why?
Well, the technical reason why, even its inventor said it wasn't appropriate the way it was being used, is because PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. In other words, they start with one piece of nucleic acid and multiply it by chain reaction with the DNA polymerase, which is the enzyme that replicates DNA. according to its inventor, even, there is about, you can go doing that to a rate of multiplication of 20 times with negligible false results. But in the PCR protocol that's being used, they're multiplying 35 times, increasing, geometrically, not exponentially, geometrically, the rate of false positive that you can get. And that's why he said that it wasn't an appropriate test for, for the coronavirus. And I think the consensus is that it gives anywhere between 10 to 15% false positives. That's a very big percentage in a diagnostic test. That is, and there was a group of 20 scientists who wrote to the European Commission to tell them that they found flaws in the protocol being used, which was based on a protocol devised, I forgot their name, but I think they're from Germany, in December of 2019 or January of 2020. And peer review by 20 European scientists, signed by 20 European scientists, said that there were flaws in that protocol. So that could be a reason. There could be a lot of false positive reported. That's not as worrisome as not reporting comorbidities, in other words, pathogenesis for people who are admitted in the hospital for COVID-19 or on the death certificate of people who die from COVID-19. If there are comorbidities, they should definitely be included. So we might be getting false positive in testing, false positive in morbidities, and false positive in mortalities.
Also, we've got one.
I can't put a rate. I can tell you in the testing, there's a 10 to 15% rate of false positives. As far as rates of morbidities that are comorbidities that are simply reported as COVID or mortalities that are caused by multiple causes besides the coronavirus, I would have, there's no data on that.
Well, look, just as an anecdotal addition into this discussion, Stanley, I met a chap last Saturday here in Wiltshire in England, just a completely random meeting. He says that in December 2019, he had something which had all the symptoms of COVID. Several days in bed with a high temperature, a very dry cough, all these basic symptoms of COVID before it was even supposed to exist in the UK. I myself had something in December too. We've heard from one of the former producers at the BBC4 here in Bristol that the Natural History Unit had a horrible disease, very much like COVID-19, arrived in their office from a foreign film crew that had just come back to the UK on the 17th of December 2019 too, and there were many of the people in the BBC went down with this. Now, what I suppose I'm trying to say here is, if this has been around, and we did have a Oxford University Oxford University report back in April, even the end of March, I think it might have been, or beginning of April 2020, saying they believed possibly 3 million people had already had COVID. I suppose what I'm saying here is that if many people have, as does look likely from some of these reports, of course, it may have been, suppressed, particularly because the disease wasn't supposed to exist in Britain at the time at all. that if so many people have had it, is there really any point in vaccinating those people? Because there are many people now who just really seem to be wanting to have a vaccine to get away, get rid of the worry of having, you know, potentially catching this.
Well, for somebody who has already had the real SARS-CoV-2 virus infection, it would be pointless, ridiculous to get vaccinated, because if the virus itself, if the real thing itself, an infection with the real thing itself did not give you immunity, a pretend infection with only part of that virus certainly will not give you more immunity. Somebody who has been infected with COVID-19 will not only have antibodies against the spike proteins, but other antigens, other protein antigens on the surface of the virus. So they would be better protected than by a vaccine. As far as who had it or who didn't have it, there are two ways to do that. Let me give you an example of somebody that I took care of. A friend of mine who came, she was feeling very sick. She lives about an hour from where I am. And she called me on the phone. She was extremely congested, and she went to get the test, the PCR test, RT-PCR test. And she tested positive. So, her being from El Salvador, she had ivermectin available. Her husband, who was out of the country, told her to go to the doctors immediately. I took the responsibility of telling her, you know what? I would not advise you, because that doctor is a cardiologist. He's not going to give you the time of day. He's going to refer you to a hospital, and they're going to hospitalize you because you're showing symptoms. You have ivermectin on hand. You have azithromycin and doxycycline on hand. Get some prednisone just in case we need it, and get an oxygen meter for your finger, and we'll monitor it from that. And by taking ivermectin, azithromycin, after the azithromycin, a course of doxycycline, ivermectin to the tune of 12 milligrams for 6 days. That is 2 pills a day. There are 6 milligram pills. And after 2 weeks, she was fine. By the way, she's 70 years old. 3 weeks later, she went to do the PCR test. And she called me and told me, great, it's negative now. So yeah, but should I get the vaccine? So let me tell you, we treated, you had the symptoms, the PCR test was positive, and we treated it. But there's also the possibility that the PCR test was a false positive, that you had the flu or another virus that we treated and that you got well, because ivermectin has a wide spectrum antiviral effect, and the antibiotics to make sure that you did not get a secondary bacterial pneumonia. Her oxygen levels never went below her PPO, partial pressure, oxygen partial, never went below 95% and went back to 99% with the treatment. But I said, to make sure that's what you had, I want you to go test it now for neutralizing antibodies to the coronavirus. Then we'll be sure that's what you had. She did, and she tested positive. I told her, now we know it was for certain the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and you have neutralizing antibodies for it in your serum. You don't need the vaccination. Forget about vaccination. Your husband can get vaccinated.
So like I said, anybody who has had the infection, well, it would be pointless to get vaccinated.
Well, what about these antibody tests? Because some of the authorities might say, well, we are testing you for antibodies. You don't test positive for the antibodies, therefore you aren't protected.
Well, this is something that's a bit of a mystery to me, because I have physician friends who told me that people who had, COVID-19 were still negative for antibodies. Now, the two people I know that I followed, that I advised on what to take, tested positive for neutralizing antibodies, where they take your blood, spin out the cells, take your serum, put it in a well, put the antigen in another well, and it gives a precipitation band. That means you have antibodies to the coronavirus. But they're reporting many people who had the and do not have neutralizing antibodies. I can't really explain that. To me, it turns immunology upside down.
No, it doesn't seem to make sense. I wonder how long do those antibodies remain? And if you haven't got antibodies, does that mean that your immune system couldn't produce them, almost instantly if it needed to?
That is precisely it. It's like if you've had chicken pox. Of course, after a year, you're not going to have a lot of detectable circulating neutralizing antibodies. But what you will have is memory B cells and memory T cells, so that when you're re-challenged by that, you're not going to get sick because you're going to get a secondary response. In other words, even if you don't have circulating coronavirus antibodies, but you had the infection and it's been, 4 or 5 months ago, and you don't have detectable levels of IgG, immunoglobulin G, in your bloodstream, doesn't mean that you're not resistant, because if you're challenged again, if your system is challenged again by the virus, you're going to get what they call a secondary response, which it seems everybody, seem to be forgetting about. This is how our immune system works. That's why we don't have to get, we had chicken pox, we are not going to get it a second time, because we'll get an immediate secondary response and neutralize the virus.
Okay, so these memory B cells can produce very quickly the antibodies when they need them. How does that actually work? How does it stop the virus?
Well, if you produce antibodies literally attached to the virus, and if you want to go deeper into it, there is something called complement fixation. Antibodies fix complement, what they call the complement cascade, that fix to the virus or viral infected cells. But that's getting a bit technical in immunology. What is important is that you have cells that already have in their genome the information for the antibody to the virus. Whereas on first infection, you don't have that information. On a secondary infection, you have to make those antibodies, you have to make those genes literally for the specificity of the antibody to that specific virus. Once that is incorporated in your genome, you have those memory cells that don't have to again see the virus and fabricate the genes at what they call the hypervariable site of the antibody to be specific for that virus. That information is already there. It's already in your genes.
Okay, so does the antibody actually attaches itself to the virus itself, does it? And somehow kind of, it's almost like maybe sticking a cork in the gun kind of thing.
Yes, and fixes complement. The virus can no longer, you know, attach to its normal target cells, to the receptors of its normal target cells, and becomes, you know, a dud.
Okay. Right, so we have seen, haven't we, that, for example, in New Zealand, the Maoris in the Spanish flu, the time of the First World War, suffered very, very badly from it. I mean, they had, I think it was something like 80% more mortality, an enormous amount more anyway than the white Europeans in New Zealand. I just wondered, you know, you're talking about this being incorporated into your genome. Is it possible to pass this immunity from the memory B cells down, you know, through generations? So perhaps the sorts of viruses which were deadly to the Maoris were much less deadly to the white Europeans there.
It's possible, but that's not part of the central dogma of immunology. According to the central dogma of immunology, when you're born, you get what they call passive immunity. This passive immunity is transferred to you from your mother, and you also get antibodies called IgA, which are secretory antibodies that are secreted in mother's milk or by the epithelial cell of your nasopharynx and the trachea. They're called IgA. There are many types of immunoglobulins, meaning antibodies. There's IgM, which is the first antibody usually manufacture against a disease. Then comes the IgG, which is the prevalent fighter. There's IgA, which is secreted in secretions and in mother's milk to her baby. And of course, there's IgE. IgE is the antibody of allergies. That's the type that attaches to mast cells and causes the massive release of histamines and cytokines and all of the other allergy moieties. Now, do you transfer, if you could transfer memory cells to your children, then if you were vaccinated with let's say diphtheria or pertussis, then your baby would have inherited this memory to make antibody and would not need to be vaccinated. That is not the case. And some vaccinations, by the way, are where you have to look at the risk factors versus benefits, are very, very useful. For example, the DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine that we get, that when we were kids, the smallpox virus, in my time when I was in school, the polio, there were two kinds of polio virus vaccines. There was the Salk and the Sabine. I got the Sabine, which was the attenuated virus that they would put a drop on a little piece of sugar and give to it. It's, you know, that doesn't mean that my kids have memory cells for polio virus. So I wouldn't think so. What one would think is that the reason that the indigenous population versus the European migrants is perhaps because the Europeans were exposed much more to flu than these people, therefore had more of the ability to react to a flu virus or had even antibodies secondary that cross-reacted with the Spanish flu that these indigenous people did not have. In other words, as far as the flu is concerned, they were starting at ground, at step one again, whereas the Europeans who had flu every year were more ready to fight this novel flu strain.
I mean, it also may be that the two communities were quite separated at the beginning anyway of the, you know, the colonization. Just looking at the figures, I mean, it's pretty striking. You've got a rate of up to 7% of Maoris dying as opposed to something like, it looks like, 70 deaths per thousand in some parts of the Maori population, as compared with the European rate of 5 per thousand. So, you know, obviously a massive difference there. I think it might be simply that, you know, blood is flowing between, particularly with obviously the mother, not to any slight on you, Stanley, but, you know, it might well be that the mother is passing some of this blood on to the children and these antibodies on to the children somehow. Is it possible for this stuff to pass through the placenta?
No, the mother does pass. Okay. I'm glad you brought that up because you know about what they call Rh factor. Like if they say you're O positive, that means you're type O Rh positive. That is your blood type, right? Or you could be A negative or positive. You could be B negative or positive, or you could be AB negative or positive. Now the positive come, the Rh come from, I don't know if you or your audience is aware of that, Rh comes from rhesus monkey. And the Rh factor is an antigen on the red blood cells. So is the A, so is the B, and so is the AB. Now, if a no mother has a child that is A, she will make antibodies to that baby in utero. She will make antibodies to the A antigen of the baby. But she will make IgM antibodies. The A, B, or AB antigens only elicit IgM response. That's where it becomes important, immunoglobulin M. And these immunoglobulins, which are the size of 4 immunoglobulin G, antibody G, do not cross the placenta. Whereas antibodies to the Rh antigen, an Rh negative mother will make antibodies to an Rh positive baby, and these at the beginning will be IgM. That's why the first baby is not in big danger. But then the mother will make IgG to the Rh factor. And these go through the placenta, and that's why the second baby is in danger. That's why an Rh negative mother has to be treated if she's going to have a second Rh positive baby. Whereas it doesn't matter if she has a different A or AB. If she's an O, which is the O is the lack of the A or B antigen. If she's an O and having an A baby, because let's suppose an O positive and an A positive baby, it doesn't matter. She will make antibodies, but they will be IgM. They will not cross the placenta. Whereas an O negative to an O positive baby, for the Rh antigen, she will make IgG antibodies, and these will cross the placenta.
Yeah, I suppose the question really is, you know, the idea that a parent might pass, a mother might pass on immunity via her DNA through obviously constructing the immune system and maybe part of the cell's ability to you know, fight things, but it also may actually come through the blood from the mother itself. As you just said, some will cross the placenta and others won't.
But if a mother has antibodies, let's say, to a common virus that will cross into the embryo, at birth, you keep this passive immunity for quite a few months, but then it's gone because this was antibodies and the ability to fight infection that is passively transferred through the placenta, but not genetically transferred through the genes.
So anyway, this is why the Maoris were, I think when the COVID scare first started in New Zealand, there were areas of Maoris, particularly in the north of the North Island, that were extremely, I mean, which should we say, they stood up the roads to their places where they were living with guns, saying we're keeping people out of here completely because of their experience in the Spanish flu. They believed, rightly or wrongly, that they were potentially much more susceptible to this. But I mean, the big question for me in many ways, well, Stanley, is look, yeah,
it's possible, it is possible that they were more susceptible because the European population was more adapted to fight flu through natural selection in Europe, just like the Europeans who came to America had a better selective natural selection for smallpox than the indigenous population, and they tried to wipe out the indigenous population, of America with smallpox. They would give them as gift, sheets. Clothing and cloth and stuff that from people who had died of smallpox. And as you know, the smallpox virus survives for months.
So, I mean, this is a rather seamy underbelly of the any pandemic is the understanding that actually viruses through history have been used in warfare, haven't they?
Yes, definitely. It was a form of, biological warfare that was used against the American indigenous population. And sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally. For example, when the Spaniards came to Hispaniola, they brought diseases that the Arawak Indians, what they call the Arawak Tainos, their immune system, these diseases did not exist in the Americas. Therefore, you did not have natural selection for a population that was resistant or had the capability to fight off those diseases. I'll give you an example where a disease can cause natural selection. Malaria. The reason you have so much sickle cell anemia in Africa is because sickle cell anemia gave the Africans resistance to malaria. Therefore, malaria selected for sickle cell anemia. I don't know if you're aware of that. This is a very well-known fact.
So what actually is sickle cell anemia?
Oh, that's a genetic mutation that causes an ineffective red blood cell. Instead of being a red blood corpuscle, it becomes a red blood crescent and defective, non-functional. It's a genetic mutation that causes the formation of dead red blood cell, which is treated now with bone marrow transplant, where hematopoietic cells are formed by giving a bone marrow transplants. Giving the stem cells for good red blood cells as opposed to defective red blood cells that you see in sickle cell anemia. The sickle cell anemia is genetically passed on from parent to children. This is something that's genetically passed on.
Okay, so what about, I mean, we've had another SARS. We had SARS-CoV-1. We had all sorts of testing for that, and various things were suggested as possible cures for it. How come it's almost as if that never happened when it comes to SARS-CoV-2, it's almost like we forgot what we'd learned from 2004 with the previous SARS.
Well, this is perhaps, to me, the biggest mistake in combating the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. COVID-19, anybody who says, well, we did the best we could and we were successful, is inherently wrong, because look what it has done. Look how many shutdowns. Look how, for a coronavirus that has a mortality rate of 1% at most. And the reason for that is that we've been concentrating, one of the reasons for that, we've been concentrating on protocols that seem to be effective against all other viruses except those that the coronavirus for which they were designed. Supposedly that's why we're not seeing all the flu epidemics or pandemics, because these measures were effective against the flu but not against the corona for which they were designed. So that's a failure. And second, we've been concentrating on vaccines for a virus that's presenting mutations with antigenic structures that do not cross-react, so that a vaccine, we might get an antigenic variant of the coronavirus for which the vaccine you receive is only 20% effective. There is cross-reaction, but very little. So what we should, I think, have concentrated on as much as vaccines, which nobody has funded, I have heard of no government funding for it, is on antiviral drugs. Something that would keep the coronavirus from replicating. Now, it so happened that we found out that a drug that was first elaborated in 1975 by a Japanese scientist called ivermectin is very effective in inhibiting the replication of the coronavirus in vitro, that is, in tissue cultures, and in people, in vivo. I told you that my friends were, two of them that were, and that got for sure infection with SARS-CoV-2, did very well with ivermectin supplemented with an antibiotic and high doses of course, vitamin C and vitamin D, which is also as important. And there's a history of finding antiviral drugs, you know, by accident. One of the best is, for example, the simple amino acid L-lysine against all types of herpes virus, from herpes type 1 causing fever blisters to herpes simplex 2 causing genital herpes or mononucleosis.
So why aren't these antivirals being used? I mean, we've seen billions spent on these vaccines, Stanley. Yes,
I know. But, for example, we found that L-lysine, a simple amino acid, inhibits the growth of herpes viruses. Just like we found that hydroxychloroquine inhibits, to a certain extent, the replication of the coronavirus. So does ivermectin. We found drugs that inhibit the retroviruses, which I mentioned before, things like actinomycin D, rifampin, AZT. We could have concentrated on finding simple molecules that inhibit the coronavirus. Now, the one antiviral that was heralded as effective and that made Gilead Pharmaceuticals close to $10 billion and the chief executives of who promptly sold a lot of their shares to personally make a lot of money, was Remdesivir.
Remdesivir is the only antiviral drug that was approved, which made, like I told you, Gilead Pharmaceutical, a ton of money. Now, let me explain to you what remdesivir is. It's an adenine analog. Now, adenine is a nucleic acid that makes up, RNA. So the idea is that the RNA replication enzyme, which is called RNA polymerase, will pick up the remdesivir instead of adenine and fool the virus and inhibit its growth that way. But unfortunately, remdesivir has a very low affinity for the RNA polymerase of the coronavirus. That's why it's not very effective at all. A drug like ivermectin is a lot more effective. Yet we've seen remdesivir being used on a massive scale in the U.S., and the U.S. having more deaths per 100,000 than any other country. This has to do with economics and money-making and nothing else. There is no other explanation for it. There are drugs that are nucleic acid analogs, like acyclovir, which are very effective against DNA polymerase. That's why they're very effective against herpes virus, which is a DNA virus. I'm sure you're familiar with acyclovir or forms of it like famvir, things that people with, herpes infections take. And it is effective, whereas the remdesivir is not effective against the RNA virus. And we've had no funding to research, to look for new antivirals that will be effective against the, any variant of the coronavirus. A vaccine, the vaccines that we're using now, the mRNA of the Moderna vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine or the RNA that was incorporated into the adenovirus vector, will make you make antibodies specifically to a specific antigen that stops the serotype of the coronavirus from which that mRNA was taken. But if there is a mutation, a new variant of coronavirus for which this antibody does not cross-react, which would be rare. It may not be as effective. It may not cross-react as much, therefore going from 92% protection to maybe only 50% protection or 40% protection. That will mean they are going to go in search of a new virus to find a new messenger RNA that codes for a specific antibody for that new variant. Whereas if you look for a drug that inhibits the replication of the virus, that inhibits the replication of the RNA, then it will be effective against any variant of the coronavirus. And it would be a treatable disease with a specific antiviral. And I think that's what ivermectin does, but we need more of it. And for some reason, ivermectin has not been promoted, at least here in the United States, as protocol for combating the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic.
Well, you know, it's the same here in the UK. I mean, we're just looking at some of the reasons why ivermectin has been not used. One is the direct communication with Jeremy Farrar, who's on the SAGE committee that makes these recommendations to the cabinet here in the UK, he hasn't even replied to a November letter from the Frontline Critical Doctors group asking him to examine all the results for ivermectin. He hasn't replied to the letter. And if you look at him, he is a former boss of, or if, in fact, he has still got a very major role in the Wellcome Foundation, which is very much invested in research into vaccines.
Well, that's regrettable. It's regrettable that we're in such a state of affairs. And I think the public is paying the price two ways. First of all, financially, because the public money that's being paid to these companies, the billions for their vaccines, is from our tax money. And second, we're paying with it with our lives, because some of these, you know, ivermectin could have saved perhaps thousands of lives. So that is really regrettable. And
well, I mean, I would say even more, possibly even just here in the UK, possibly even tens of thousands of lives, and across the world, God knows how many.
Well, across the world, a lot of people are using ivermectin. For example, I know of four countries that put it in their protocol to treat, SARS Corona-2, and they have very low mortality, very, very low mortality.
So which countries are those?
All right. El Salvador, Honduras, India has started the same, distributing ivermectin. By the way, preventatively, as a preventive, because it's a comparatively very cheap drug compared to remdesivir. Not quite as cheap as chloroquine, but close. The Dominican Republic, and now Haiti. The first country that I was aware of that was using remdesivir as national policy was Honduras. Then came El Salvador, and I'm sure there are others that I don't know about.
I mean, so how can it be that something which is a cheap, well, it's not a cure, but it's certainly, the statistics are around 75% recovery rates, you know, up a bit, some a bit more, some a bit less, using ivermectin. How come Haiti has got it right and Europe and the United States have got it wrong?
You know, it's very funny. Money, it has to have to be with money. Look, the American public, I don't know if it's the same in England, but the American public is the most exploited as far as the health industry is concerned. It's because remdesivir cost, the cost of treatment of remdesivir is about $12,000 in hospital. That's what your insurance company, or you personally, if you don't have insurance, or if you're old enough that your Medicare has to pay for. And do you know how they justified it? Do you know how Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, justified that cost? Not because the cost of production is high, but because they say, according to their research, it reduces hospital stay by 3 days. Look at the original publication on why remdesivir was recommended. It reduces hospital stay by 3 to 4 days, which I don't think it has, but they say it has. It hasn't saved lives, obviously. Those who were critically ill, we wouldn't have that high of mortality among hospital patients. And they said $12,000 is less than 3 or 4 additional days in hospital in the U.S. And I have my cousin's brother, well, he's my cousin through marriage, who died here at Baptist Hospital after 3 weeks on respirator and remdesivir. And that's why I told my And this was back in July. And that's why 2 months ago, when my friend here, I told her, do not go to the doctor. You go to the hospital. Once you're in, I cannot tell you what to take. And I remember when my cousin's brother was in hospital, we were talking to his wife, and whenever she would call the hospital, she was not allowed in back in July. People were in total isolation, and they would tell her that we're following CDC recommendation. And I'll never forget, the week before he died, 3 days before he died, they said they think he's doing better. 3 days later, he was dead. And he had a full course of remdesivir to the cost of $12,000.
So you're saying basically follow the money. I mean, this is horrific, isn't it? Anyway, what about this cytokine storm we keep hearing about? Because they have been treating people essentially in these protocols for, it seems to me, to be pneumonia, whereas surely these protocols, which apparently if you start to vary from them, the authorities get rather cross with you. In fact, possibly might even sack a doctor that doesn't follow the protocol. That some people are saying that by putting people onto respirators, that actually may have made things worse because it's a cytokine storm that's going on, not pneumonia. Can you explain to us what the difference is and whether you think that's the case? That was what was going on with SARS-CoV-2.
That was found out. That is one of the effects that it has on the alveoli once the infection gets to the lungs. The cytokine storm would cause cytokine is the release of, it's a histamine-like substance. It's a release from your own cells as an allergic reaction. And this cytokine storm was causing, the lungs, the alveoli of the lungs, by causing a bunch of microclots, microthrombosis of the lungs, causing people to not getting enough oxygen and dying, even on a respirator, because you were forcing oxygen down their lungs, but they were not absorbing it because the alveoli were not picking up the oxygen for the hemoglobin that's circulating. By the way, and that's why I told you I had my friend get some prednisone in case it was needed. Had her, blood oxygen gone down below 95% and her lung condition deteriorated, I would have had her take prednisone to prevent that cytokine storm. That is steroid. That's like cortisone. You know what prednisone is, right? And this is one of the reasons that treatment with hydroxychloroquine was somewhat effective in treating coronavirus, because hydroxychloroquine, not only has it been used for the last 70 years for malaria and saved millions of lives, but in the last two decades, it's a great immune modulator. It's used to prevent autoimmune reactions in rheumatoid arthritis. Now it's part of the regimen for rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus. That could explain the success that the doctor in France, in Marseille, achieved with hydroxychloroquine.
Okay, now the big question, I suppose, for many people now is, just as we all thought that the vaccinations, the actual rates of COVID going down was going to mean that everything was going to be opening up again, almost a return to normal, if you can cross your fingers and hope for that. We keep hearing now about all these new variants. So, how do you think we know whether these new variants are either more transmissible or more dangerous? In other words, a sort of more virulent virus. And what's the best thing to do to mitigate against new variants?
According to me, the best thing to do to mitigate against new variants is to take, ivermectin preventively, to use it prophylactically, because it will protect against any of the variants, because its mode of action does not depend on the antigenic structure of the spike protein. So that would be the best way. If you ask me a direct question right now, this is my direct answer. As far as new variants being more contagious, that is possible. As far as being more lethal, that is less possible. Because it is in a virus's, in evolution, a virus will, it is in its evolutionary advantage to cause less damage and be more transmissible rather than kill its host and not be transmitted. Killing its host is an evolutionary dead end for a virus. Whereas making its the least sick it makes its host, the variant that makes the host the least sick, that allows the host to mingle with people and transmit it more rapidly, will be the one naturally selected. Whereas the one that puts its host in hospital and totally incapacitates its host has less chance of being propagated. I mean, I think you can follow that. And so therefore, variants that are more transmissible is an evolutionary trend. Viruses that are more lethal, that are more lethal is not a good evolutionary trend for the virus.
Well, we keep hearing, don't we, about variants popping up in different parts of the world, or are they being transmitted around the world by air travel?
That, you know, when the first variant came out, and the reaction was close airport, no circulation, I immediately said this was useless. The British variant, which is called B1117, is now in 82 countries. It didn't go there by travel. The reason you have these variants, the reason you have these mutations, is because it's the most likely spot on the RNA, on the genome of the virus, for a mutation to occur. And it occurs because this is, you know, the most probable form of mutation of the virus. And I knew it was going to pop up everywhere, and I said so, you know, when it first started, that restricting travel is not an answer, because it's going, just because it was detected in England first, in the UK first, doesn't mean it's not occurring other places. It just means scientists there detected that antigenic variant first in the UK. And sooner or later, now it's in 82 countries. So it's not people who traveled to England or came back from England that brought it there. It just, that mutation naturally happened because it's the most probable thermodynamically for the RNA strand of that virus.
So the same mutation is happening, you know, in different parts of the world, just simply because the virus original strain is kind of running out of steam. So it's thinking, well, I'm mutating a little bit, I suppose there's millions and millions of these viruses being produced, and each one is maybe a little bit of a mutation, and it's just going to happen anywhere. So Stanley, where's the best place for people to follow your work? I know you've been on ResearchGate, haven't you, which is one of the places where these things get discussed. It's a bit like a sort of professional industry, if you can call medicine an industry, I suppose they do now, don't they? Professional place where people can discuss these sorts of things. And you've been weighing in on several discussions there. I wonder, have you managed to get any headway with some of your ideas and get anyone to listen to you even?
Well, from what I get, the feedback I get from them is that I'm getting the discussions that I've started and the points of views that I've put in are among the most read, in the thousands. And I've had, it's one of some of the rare discussions where there's over, 200 back and forth between scientists from everywhere, from those who criticize to those who agree and present data. Some present data that support what I say that I wasn't aware of. Others argue, about different things. But this is mostly where I, where I can be followed, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, and I think it's so important that there is this discussion going on, because it seems to me in the mainstream media, and we've been hearing about the ivermectin being actually blocked from even being published in journals, discussions about that being withdrawn, even though it's been peer-reviewed, the people just simply will not publish it, that there are places where these discussions can take place. This is another big sign of this, is it seems to me that, I don't know if you've experienced this, Stanley, that the discussion has been kind of curtailed, that the solutions have not been allowed to find their way to the places where the decisions are being made.
Definitely. And there's also the other thing that in the places where the decisions are being made, there might be conflicts of interest. I know that is definitely so here in the US. I can't say about the UK, but here in the US, it is definitely so. Because we have a revolving door policy here in the United States between pharmaceutical companies and the FDA that's supposed to be regulating the pharmaceutical companies. For the last eight administrations, we've had heads of the FDA come directly from the pharmaceutical industry, and after their tenure as head of the FDA, go back to the pharmaceutical industry. So that's an intolerable situation, a situation that should not be tolerated, but that is common practice in the United States. It's time, as Goethe once said, for the people to wake up and let a tempest loose on the head of the people who are who are making this becoming the norm. Notice, it would not have been possible in the 60s and 70s.
Stanley Layam, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tony.